De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
Cool. Hi, thanks for coming, everyone. My name is Miles. I work for Haymarket Books. Thanks again for being so. We're here today to talk about Our History of the Future with Nick Estes. Nick is an enrolled member of the Lower Brule Sioux Tribe and is an associate professor in American Indian Studies at the University of Minnesota. He studies colonialism and global indigenous histories, focusing on decolonization, oral history, U.S. imperialism, environmental justice, anti-capitalism, and the Aseti Sakolin. He is also the author of Our History is the Future, the new paperback edition of this, which was published just 2 months ago, including a new afterword from Nick, and a really important book, especially for these moments where we're seeing the sharp end of settler colonialism in action, both here and in Gaza. I'll pass over to Nick. We will be having a Q&A later. When we do that, I'll give a quick little intro so that we know how that's working. But for now, I'm going to pass over to Nick. Thanks.
Hamatak Yapi. It's good to be here, and it's good to be invited to the Socialism Conference. And I'm going to talk a little bit about the book, the background, why I wrote it, how it came about. But I also want to talk a little bit about this current political moment and why the book needed a new afterword. It's not just for marketing purposes, although if you want to buy the book, you can. I'm doing a book signing at the books thing over there afterwards. So if you want a book signed or whatever, I also have some swag for people, stickers, if you come up and talk to me. It's not like I need to, incentivize people to communicate or be my friends, but if you want a sticker, I have them on me. But this book actually in many ways began here in this city, in Chicago. I was here on a fellowship in September of 2019. I literally came from the camps at Standing Rock to do fellowship at the Newberry. And I didn't stop organizing around Standing Rock in 2016. I just came here and I plugged into the organizing scene that was happening around, Indigenous solidarity, specifically at the Chicago American Indian Center. Here's your phone. It was an interesting moment in my organizing career, in my short time on this planet. But it was a time when you could go to any kind of major city in the so-called United States and people knew what indigenous struggles meant because they saw it happening at Standing Rock. Another aspect of the Standing Rock movement or moment was this, this understanding or the spectacular kind of form of violence that was taking place and the repression that was happening, at the hands of what we found out later were 92 different law enforcement jurisdictions deployed under emergency management compact, legislation that allowed states to sort of petition and get law enforcement support from different states around the country. That was what was making news. And, it was just good in many ways. It amplified the movement. But what was also a little bit disappointing in some ways or limiting in that sort of perspective is that it didn't really show the long history of contestation over Minishoshe, what we call the Missouri River, And this kind of longer struggle, specifically around water rights, but also what I, you know, what I called the long tradition of indigenous resistance. And I do a lot of interviews on this book, or have done a lot of interviews and talks, but a lot of people don't actually ask me about that, the last phrase in the subtitle, and I think it's important to show because, you know, recently, with some of my, you know, friends and relatives, you know, Leanne Simpson's in the audience, we created Indigenous for Palestine, and Leanne wrote a piece in that, on that that website, or that, you know, that project, that campaign that we had, about sort of this long tradition of Indigenous solidarity with Palestine. We didn't invent anything. Like, there's this intention or this kind of movement or impulse to like do something innovative and new. And I find it troubling, especially in our movements, because it's like we have a lot of foundation to build on, actually. Like, there's things, you know, within the own Indigenous movement, within the Ocheté Chalcomi struggles, that are really beautiful and powerful. You know, one of the things that I grew up learning was, you know, the connection with the American Indian movement and the Palestine movement. That wasn't something that was like talked about. And today it seems like novel, hey, let's connect these two struggles. When in fact, as I tried to show in this book and in, you know, other projects, this is something that was like deeply ingrained. We weren't just parochial sort of people who, you know, lived along this river and, you know, were colonized and were just trying to get better rights within a settler state. You know, there were, this idea of internationalism was very much alive even in the early 20th century, when we weren't even citizens of this country, but were being conscripted into the military to, you know, fight in World War I, but had no representation. We had no Fifth Amendment rights. We had no way to even defend ourselves in the courts of the conqueror. We were, like, if anyone knows anything about history, we know that the Marshall Trilogy, though, you know, the Cherokee cases, the Cherokee removal cases, those were all adjudicated by non-native people because Cherokee people weren't citizens and they had no standing under federal law. That was the same in the 20th century. And so you had the rise of organizations like the Society of American Indians, which actually was the brainchild of treaty councils that existed, that were formed in the late 1800s as a response to the reservation system. They were allied with organizations, some of the founders of the NAACP, people like W.E.B. Du Bois. He was the only non-native voting member of the Society of American Indians. That was in the 1910s. And if we think about Black Indigenous solidarity, you know, that's more than a century. But people are acting, sorry, I don't want to get on, I was on the last panels on, they'd be like, don't be so righteous. As one of the, you know, the questions was, but that's a history worth sort of delving into, and it's a foundation to build off of, and so that's really the purpose of this book. I wrote it as I abandoned my original dissertation project. I was in a, you know, a PhD program, and my friend or my mentor at the time, Alex Lubin, was like, hey, well. He's like, you should just write a book, you know? And I was like, okay, how do you do that? And he's like, well, there's people who, you know, there's people at Verso, you know, you should, I'll introduce you. And then that's how the book came about. And I, you know, my dissertation was a book before it was a dissertation in many ways, because I just couldn't think of anything that I could write about in this moment in time. So I focused my energy on trying to narrate not only this struggle, but to show the sort of deep histories that existed within the Ocheté Chalcomi and our understanding not only of this place in this moment within a larger movement in history at Standing Rock, but also like what this current moment like teaches us within the broad sweep of history. So that's really where it came from. And my you know, I grew up in Chamberlain, South Dakota. Two of my grandfathers, and we don't really have like the kind of normative, when I say grandfathers, people actually think that I'm like, they're like my actual grandfathers in like the white way. But it's like, we have a lot of grandfathers and I don't have time to explain it, but it's just the way it works, right? So whenever, like, and there's also this joke, because when you become a federal employee, they ask you if you've if you've ever, I'm not a federal employee, I just know that this is a question they ask. They ask you if any of your family members have taken up arms against the United States government. But they mean it in the white way, so it's kind of, you know, God bless them, whatever. So this history comes down, you know, is transmitted from my grandparents. Specifically, I could trace it to my grandmother, Cornelia Shawala, and my grandfather, Ruben Estes. And Cornelia Shawala was somebody who read and wrote and spoke English really well. She also spoke Lakota. And my grandfather read and wrote, or he spoke English and spoke Lakota, but he never read or wrote in either language. He was effectively illiterate. And he was the first tribal chairman of our tribe back in 1935. So whenever these Congress people were writing, they were actually writing to my grandmother, who was reading these letters and translating them to my grandfather. And he was articulating, you know, an assertion of authority. He said, not without the consent of our people will you develop our river. But those are actually my grandmother's words, you know. So this history is really deep and personal within my own family. And I think the other part of it was when we went to Standing Rock, you know, there was some people who came up to me in the previous talk and, you know, were talking about the youth runners. You know, this is an intergenerational story. It's not something that is just like, you know, you have like grown-ups who are taking charge of a situation. You know, President Barack Obama was like one of, I think, six sitting presidents to visit an Indian reservation in his tenure as president. And he went to Standing Rock for a Flag Day powwow, I think in 2013 or 2014. And he promised that he was going to do everything in his power to look out for the best interests of Standing Rock youth and Indigenous youth in general. And these youth took him to his word. So when they pushed the Dakota Access Pipeline, they tried to go through the normal channels of, you know, petitioning the Army Corps of Engineers, trying to petition the Democrats. It was a very similar time period as we are now, actually. They ran relay runs from Standing Rock all the way to Washington, D.C. They built a teepee in the campaign offices of Hillary Clinton in Washington, D.C., and she, you know, of course, escorted them out with her security guards. And, you know, this was a Democratic president. This happened under, you know, a Democratic president of the United States. Standing Rock happened under a Democratic president of the United States. The Dakota Access Pipeline was built under a Democratic president of the United States, and it continues to operate under a Republican and then a Democratic president of the United States. And so the previous panel, you know, there were some questions about, you know, people were sort of like, well, you know, we got to vote for somebody. The question isn't about, you know, voting, because if I was a single issue voter and I said, well, I want to stop pipelines, then who do I vote for? You know, it's a very cynical politics. And the movement that happened in 2016 exposed those sort of contradictions. But here we are, like two presidential cycles later, and we're still hearing and seeing the exact same rhetoric and the exact same narratives. The only difference is that there's a unified, you know, political, bipartisan, you know, structure for the genocide of Palestinians, right? Typically, they're unified around the dispossession of native lands here, but now we're seeing what unites the two parties is a broader policy of genocide. And I think what I was trying to show in this moment, or in this book, is to think about this not in this really kind of pressing urgency of the now, but thinking about it within the longer stretch of history. So that's kind of a gist of the book. There's been a lot of, I'm wearing this shirt. It says Free Leonard Peltier. And I want to talk a little, I want to spend the rest of my time, I touch a little bit about it on the book. But speaking about, advocating under, you know, Democratic presidents after Standing Rocks, after Chairman Archambault asked people to leave the camps, I went to Washington, D.C. to petition for Leonard Peltier's clemency from Barack Obama. And I remember when we went into people's congressional offices, they gave us the same talking points. Well, you know, Trump is coming in and it's going to be really bad. Like, we don't want to, you know, the FBI, blah, 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 blah. And I remember I was in a hotel that was near the Watergate Hotel. I didn't remember that because, you know, the Watergate history. And Leonard Peltier's son, Waha, was there with us. And he actually died in the room next to me, petitioning for his father's freedom. And I say this because a lot of people think that this history has passed, that it's something, you know, the annihilation of Native lives and families is something that happens in the past, but it's a very present reality. And to give you an example, under the Biden administration, you know, as much as it was under the Trump administration and the Obama administration, the FBI has continued to advocate against his clemency and his release. And there's a lot of, you know, one of the criticisms, critiques of this book that I received from a friend of mine, Julian Brave Noisecat, was the American Indian movement, as much as, you know, we want to look back as a good resistance movement, also killed its own members in terms of the slaying and the assassination of Anime Aquash in particular. And I was like, you're correct about identifying this murder that happened in this moment of paranoia and repression. But there's also 56 other people who were murdered. There were Lakota people, Lakota women who were murdered. Do you remember their names? Can anybody name any of the names beyond, if you know that history, can anyone name the names beyond Anime Aquash? The FBI was asked multiple times to investigate these murders, these beatings, these rapes that happened on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation and beyond, since they have, you know, sole jurisdiction. Today, the FBI is tasked with murdered missing Indigenous women and murdered missing Indigenous relatives to investigate these things on the reservation. And I want to talk a little bit about the slaying of Anime Aquash and Leonard Peltier's case, because this is something that I think is really important that we understand the sort of power of the political of the settler state and its repression of Indigenous movements and its distortion of our own histories. This is kind of extending a little bit beyond the confines of this book, but I think it's important to say, because Leonard Peltier's last chance at freedom is this presidency. He's not going to live any longer into another term. And with that is the weight of this history that has been, you know, burdened, you know, that has been burdened unfairly onto Indigenous peoples. So back in the 90s, the Department of Justice refused to prosecute or to take any of the named or alleged killers of Anime Aquash to trial because there wasn't enough evidence. That was back in the 1990s. Back in 1975, there was an FBI file that was released that showed that an informant December 19th, 1975, if I'm remembering correctly, had told his handler in Denver, Colorado, that he knew the names of the people who had kidnapped and murdered Anime Aquash, where it was done, and in what manner it was done. That was in December of 1975. According to the state, the federal, the state's theory of the case, she was kidnapped, or she was murdered on December 12th, 1975. So a week after her assassination, the FBI knew. They had the names, the dates, and the means, but never brought any charges against anyone until 30 years later. And I'm covering a lot of ground here, and this may not be history familiar to you all, but I think it's important because one of the main weapons against Leonard Peltier's freedom is the massive distortion around his case, and particularly this alleged connection he had in the killing of his friend and his comrade, Anime Aquash. So there were three individuals who were named as conspirators. You know, all three of them were former AIM members or affiliated with AIM. One of them was never tried. One of them never spent a day in jail, for her orchestration as the main conspirator around the assassination of Anime Aquash. And it was put in the record during the trials that Leonard Peltier had admitted to Anime Aquash that he had killed these two FBI agents in June of 1975. And people who were there at that supposed disclosure of information actually have come out later and said that that's actually not what happened. And the two people who testified against these individuals who were later tried and convicted of her killing, two of them were FBI agents or FBI informants. One was the former wife of Dennis Banks, Kamook Nichols. The other was a pretendian, a guy named Cyril Chapman, who is still out in the world today making videos about murdered missing indigenous women. He's got a new documentary out. It was just on Dr. Phil. If you don't believe me, just Google it. he goes by Sunbear now or something like that. So it was his supposed, infiltration of the movement and getting them to confess that led to these convictions. And if you know anything about these histories, we've seen this new sort of history kind of unfold and reveal around the Black Panther Party and the assassination of Fred Hampton and the level of FBI infiltration and distortion of that particular history. But yet we're supposed to believe the FBI's narrative when it tells us that it was actually AIM who were the misogynists and the perpetrators of violence against indigenous women. I'm not saying that there weren't members, but it also ignores that most of AIM was made up of indigenous women. You can go down the hall to the exhibit and see the Warrior Women Project that demonstrates the influence of American Indian women, specifically Lakota women, in that struggle. So the FBI has played on this particular narrative to demonize, discredit, and create obfuscation, when in fact it knew for almost 30 years that this had happened and how it happened. And the question and the impetus on answers is in their court. It's not in our court. And it's to say that this long history. So why would, what's the point of keeping Leonard Peltier in prison after, half a century? It's because they want to imprison our history. They want us to be ashamed of our past and our history. And they want to create this distortion. Yeah, there were problems within the Red Power movement. Nobody's denying that. But it also does a complete injustice towards the freedom fighters who gave their lives for this movement. And I'll say, to cite Hank Adams, if you don't know who Hank Adams is, he was somebody who was not always on board with what AIM did, but he's considered the late Hank Adams, he's considered a movement elder. He talked about Anime Aquash and he said that AIM's ways were Anime's ways for better or worse. She died an AIM member. And the distortions that have happened have pitted the people who were actually there protecting her, Leonard Peltier, and the Northwest AIM group actually took Anime Aquash under their wing because people were accusing her of being an FBI informant. But the history has been completely distorted to the point that the FBI, now look at Killers of the Flower Moon, comes out on top as some sort of purveyor of justice for indigenous women. This is the kind of topsy-turvy, upside-down world that we're living in right now. And this, this book itself, and I also, if we want to talk about repression, this book itself landed me a federal subpoena in a civil case in North Dakota because an anthropologist by the name of Dana Powell told a DOJ attorney that I had witnessed illegal activities at the time I was in the Standing Rock camps. And I was subpoenaed. They came to my house that I was supposed to testify. And I luckily had, there was this legal infrastructure that was built up around water protectors. And I'm just an academic, man. I'm not that wild, but I was the first person to have written this book and have written extensively on this particular movement. So I was targeted for that particular reason by another academic who claims she knew me. I don't know Dana Powell. I saw her several times in the Standing Rock camp, so I don't know why she's talking to DOJ attorneys saying that I had witnessed something that I had not witnessed. And so when I had to go and sit under a federal deposition, which is just a fishing exercise because there's no statute of limitations on some of the things they're trying to charge people out with, they asked me if I saw illegal activities, and I said, of course I did. I've documented them in this book. They violate your own constitution. Article 6 of the Constitution says treaties are the supreme law of the land. Yeah, of course I saw a lot of illegal activities. Of course I saw vandalism. And in the process of this, they're trying to, you know, they're trying to subpoena more people to have a chilling effect, that we can't even write about these recent struggles because people don't want to come forward and talk about it. You know, we see this in terms of like what's happening in Palestine, right? And I'm not saying I'm any kind of hero. I'm not. What I've done is nowhere close to the kind of risks that our Palestinian relatives are taking right now in this moment. It's nowhere close. But they grant me a courage that I don't have. They serve as an inspiration for our movements, and this is what the afterword of this book is about, is to look not only at the indigenous struggle, the movement at Standing Rock, within this sort of parochial lens concentrated on a specific area, but to look at the long, you know, histories of resistance, not just repression. You know, we can sit and think about the modes by which the FBI has used our own relations, you know, against us. There's reporting that has come out by one of my really good friends, Aileen Brown. You should all subscribe to her newsletter called Ecofiles, where she documents that at any given moment, and you know, during the Standing Rock encampments, there was between 1 to 10 FBI informants that had infiltrated the camps. And these were people's relatives. Again, targeting the very kinship structure of indigenous people, creating senses of paranoia, informing, you know, on people. For what? You know, one of the first comparisons that came out by Tiger Swan was the comparison of Standing Rock and Water Protectors as a jihadi-inspired movement, right? So the first thing they went to was Palestine, right? And the first thing that they began to document was the presence of Palestinians and the Palestine flag. Because they understood that, you know, the corporate state, you know, imperialism, it's very intersectional. People are like against that word now, but it's like, no, this is what it's been doing the entire time. They're intersectional. They see these movements as you know, connected and as equally dangerous, right? They're seeing, you know, the connections of Palestine activists within the camps of Standing Rock as a way to delegitimize, but it never delegitimized Standing Rock. It never delegitimized the indigenous movement. It actually made it stronger. And it has made it stronger. Their movement, their resistance has made our resistance stronger. Of course they're gonna want us, you know, subpoena us and have, you know, us feel suspicious of each other. But I think, you know, the antidote to all of that is to bring the stuff out into the open and to continue to tell these stories and these histories and to be proud of them for all their faults, for all of the things that they got wrong, you know, for all the struggles that we have, you know, we have undertaken as the Ocheti Shakoi, as indigenous people, as people who are involved in the water protector movement. And, you know, I don't have much else to say other than to just, I want to read a poem. And I don't write poetry, so if you want to critique it, that's fine. But I wrote this poem, sort of like an essay slash poem, when I was in Ramallah and I smelled the sea, and I was just like, it was such a weird experience because like it's like I can leave this place, I can go to the sea, but most of the people I met, these beautiful Palestinian relatives, can't go to the sea, and like how jarring that was. In Palestine, I learned that poetry measures distance. Bint Nakba, and don't you forget it, my grandfather warned me. Jehan Biseso read from her poem commemorating the Nakba 70th anniversary in an East Jerusalem basement theater. We were told the Gazan rioters were not allowed to leave the world's largest open-air prison to participate in this year's Palestine Festival of Literature. How far was Gaza? I wondered. Our indigenous territories seem large and vast, but Palestine seems so small on the map in comparison. The distance to Gaza is measured by security checkpoints, I was told, which can take hours or days to access or to cross if one is lucky. And for millions, the right of return to one's homeland is measured by concrete walls, concertina wire, citizenship status, stamps on a passport, Arabic names, UN resolutions, the Israeli nation state law, and families of settlers occupying Palestinian homes and villages. In Ramallah, Omar Barghouti, co-founder of the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, told us he was on his way to the United States to attend his daughter's wedding and to speak about the right to peacefully boycott one's occupiers. I told him to meet with American Indian leaders when he arrived and that he's always welcome in our Lakota homelands. as a friend and as a relative. These words were useless, however, because days later, our occupier denied him access to our home. From Palestine, the distance to Turtle Island is measured by visas and walls, settler laws, and State Department directives. The Great March of Return was also a measure of distance. How far was one willing to travel for freedom, and at what cost? Palestinian historian Salman Abu Sitta reminds us that many of the hundreds of villages emptied after the Nakba in southern Palestine are walkable from Gaza. In other words, the right of return for hundreds of thousands is within walking distance. During the Great March of Return, Israeli snipers targeted the backs of knees to force amputation as Gazans attempted to cross the perimeter fence. Jahan's poem sticks in my mind, and if we lose our legs, we will crawl on our hands and elbows. Despite the distance, we must travel for freedom. Palestine is always near my heart. Colonial time creates different temporalities. It speeds up and slows down. It's thick like mud, weighing on the feet of the colonized, attempting to stick them in place, in the past or in forever negation. The feet of the colonizer, on the other hand, are light and mobile. The colonizer's time is quick. A US passport, the right color skin, the correct language, anything but Arabic, and an entitled jaunt grant fast access to a world others only dream about, a sidewalk, an access road, air, an ocean. Yet the colonial reality is meant to exaggerate time to make its novelty on the historical stage seem as natural as the olive groves and rolling hills. Like the ocean or Gaza, the history of known freedom is just over that hill. Though it stretches far back into time, it is familiar to everyone, a poem, a song, a story, a stone. You can smell it. It's the fire that still burns in our hearts, thousands of grasslands and sacred mountains away, where we also put our feet in the dirt, grasped our history, and said no, and we came crashing down on them like waves of history.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.